Well, and thanks to the Center for hosting this discussion tonight, and thanks to all of you for braving what was promised to be very inclement weather. But the night is young. Let me just say a few words about our panelists this evening before we turn it over to them and hear some initial thoughts. With me this evening is Eric Kibiak. He is the executive director and co-founder of Hudsonia, a non-advocacy, non-profit institute for conservation science research and education in the Northeast. Eric is here tonight to also to really focus some of his expertise on an untold, kind of an undertold part of the fracking story, that is impacts on biodiversity. A lot of his research looks at how fracking in the Marcellus Shale may impact the habitats of organisms whose habitat is either partially or wholly within the area potentially impacted by gas drilling. George Robinson is an associate professor of biological sciences at the University of Albany and is affiliated with its graduate program in biodiversity, conservation, and public policy. George's research has looked at many of the disturbances that can arise from hydrofracking and the cost to both the natural and the human communities where fracking might occur. Stu Bruskin, here at stage left, has spent a lifetime, something just short of Stu's lifetime, in public policy. He was in the State Assembly as a staff member for Assemblyman Pete Grannis for many years. He spent 25 years in the private sector practicing both commercial and real estate law, and then for 4 years served as the executive deputy of the Department of Environmental Conservation. That Stu was at the agency when this debate over fracking began in 2008 and 2009. He's now in private consulting, focusing mostly on energy, environmental, and economic development issues. And then last, but certainly not least, we're pleased to have Andy Repkin here. Andy's a veteran reporter of the New York Times. I think all of us have read Andy's work over the years. He was one of the reporters that really deserves a lot of credit for shining a light on the issues around climate change and fossil fuel dependence. And Andy has been through his work on Dot Earth, along with his continued reporting at the New York Times, to shed light on numerous environmental issues, and he has been covering the issue of hydrofracking as well. So thank you all for participating this evening. So I've asked each of the members of the panel to think about answering a very simple question to kick us off and to give a 3 or 4 minute opening statement. We're going to start with you, Eric. If you could just real quickly, so the audience knows exactly what point you're trying to make this evening, and could you just tell us, like, what's the one thing you would like the audience to be able to leave here this evening knowing that perhaps they didn't know when they arrived today?
Well, I'd like you to think about how fracking will affect biological diversity, that is, species and their genes and habitats, and whether those impacts can be mitigated or reduced or not. Shall I proceed?
Absolutely.
Thank you. So, biodiversity is critical to human survival, and if any of you have thought about this, look in your medicine cabinet, you can see many examples of that importance, or in your refrigerator. We can't do without it. The variety of native species is extremely important to us. Fracking in the Marcellus and Utica shales is transforming the landscape in a very large region, more than 40,000 square miles, potentially including New York, if we proceed here. And this region has a rich diversity of species of native plants and animals and other organisms. In concert with coal mining and other land uses, fracking is fragmenting large existing tracts of forest land into small patches. Fragmentation degrades forest habitat for many species that do well only in extensive forest. There are species that are quite happy in forest edges and in open areas, and many species that require extensive forest that is not crisscrossed with pipeline corridors and drilling pads. Fragmentation in these landscapes is combining with alterations of water levels and flows, salinization, and chemical contamination to affect biodiversity. So we have several kinds of impacts in a general sense acting together. We don't really know what most of the outcome of that will be, or is being in states like Pennsylvania. Studies of biodiversity in an industrial area that's not a gas drilling area, but affected by analogous impacts, indicates that certain groups of organisms will disappear from or have fewer species in fracking landscapes. These groups include coniferous trees, orchids, true sedges, genus Carex, fern allies, land snails, freshwater mussels, crayfishes, stream insects, stream fishes, amphibian snakes, and fur bearers, and others. So we have a lot of kinds of animals and plants that are sensitive to the kinds of impacts that are being generated by fracking. Could I have the first slide, please, Rob? Okay, so while this is coming up, I'll make my last point. My colleagues and I analyzed 15 species of mostly animals and some plants that have small geographic ranges overlapping 36 to 100% with the Marcellus and Utica shales. This analysis suggests that species with these characteristics, small geographic ranges substantially overlapping the gas drilling region in the eastern U.S., will be especially sensitive to fracking development and may be at risk of extinction as a result. So let's just look at these. This is my last point. Let's just look at these examples here. This is the boundary of the combined Marcellus and Utica gas shales. The green areas are the geographic range of this small rare stream fish, and the crosshatched areas are where that fish's geographic range overlaps with the gas shales. So you can see that depending which species you look at, you can have a very high degree of overlap. And that means that potentially through a very large part of or throughout the range of a particular species, that species may be affected by forest fragmentation and the other impacts that I mentioned.
Thanks a lot, Gary.
George. Okay, so I guess the one point I'd like to make is, this whole situation is a dilemma for a lot of us. It's also a possible opportunity because we've had time to think about it compared to a lot of other resource extraction issues. And we do have an opportunity to approach it rationally, which would be revolutionary, but it's out there. It's actually, the possibility is out there. In support of what Eric was saying, I'd like to quote a United States president. "We have no reason to suppose that all of Earth's resources, which support so much living diversity, can rightfully be commandeered to support mankind alone." So which president do you think said that? Go back to 195 years ago. James Madison said that. This is not a new idea. I'd like to also quote two of the writers as part of the testimony. I'm just citing Jack McEnany. It's not quotes, just facts. Natural gas first came to Albany to replace lamp oil in the 1840s, and in 1929, there were 59 gas electric companies because it all combined, and now we have one. I'd like to quote Bill Logan. "Rural America is where the cities conduct their most dangerous experiments and where they seek to dump what they cannot contain. In most cases, the soil is their victim." It's from his really great book, Dirt. So we can flip a few slides here. I'm talking about an economy that's expanding inside a nature that cannot expand. Could we keep moving? So we're extracting resources and then dumping the waste. So nature has to get smaller as the economy expands. And so the point is, are we going to do something about this or just continue business as usual in a haphazard kind of free-for-all fashion? So we have a model where we ruled out some potential frack locations, location being about a square mile. And we used three criteria that are very similar to criteria spelled out in section 6 of the 2011 BEC EIS update. And part of the result are maps like this, where the red, the dark area, is what we think is excludable for obvious reasons of inaccessibility or protected natural areas. And then we got two other colors, and if we exploited 50% of the shale in a rational way, in other words, taking the 50% least sensitive areas, we might have a better opportunity to protect that other 50%. And this could be 10% versus 90%, the percents aren't that important. The point is, this is distributed by town. There's over 400 rural towns and 11 urban towns within this shale boundary. And if you distributed each town on a rational basis and people who did get the benefits of the resources paid on a graded system, so the more sensitive the area, the higher the fee, I think we could approach this in a rational way that hasn't been done probably anywhere in the U.S. And that's what I'd share with the governor.
Thanks, Stu. Thanks, Rob. So my answer to Rob's question is that I hope that after tonight's discussion that we leave here really with a more of an understanding of some of the complexities of this issue, the multiple facets and the policy challenges that we're facing, and perhaps reach a conclusion that this really doesn't translate well to just a black and white pro or con point of view. The fracking issue is the perfect intersection of energy, environmental, climate change, and economic development policy, and it's very dangerous when you try to subordinate any one of those to the other. So you don't want to say, let's subordinate environmental concerns because we care about job creation, for example. Very dangerous to do. You have to recognize that there are legitimate policy goals with each of those and that they're linked and try to find those linkages. DEC's job in this has never been to decide whether or not there should be fracking in New York State. Based on the public debate, that's what you might think DEC is doing, but that's not really DEC's job. As a regulator, DEC is required to very carefully, comprehensively, and critically look at this industrial process, evaluate all the potential impacts, and apply objective scientific and engineering standards to ensure that the environment is protected. And that's a legal, technical, administrative process. It's not really a policy determination. And in fact, it's the same approach that DEC is required to take with regard to any industrial process that's legal to do in New York State. So there's really a disconnect between what's been going on at DEC, what DEC's job is, and what's been debated in the media, on the blogs, in various forums, and so on. But there are a lot of public policy issues, and maybe one way to think of it is that DEC's decision is really only the first step. When DEC comes out with whatever it's going to come out with, that's going to be a roadmap that's technical. It's going to say that if this is going to be permitted in New York, these are the conditions that are going to apply. There's a host of other issues that still have to be dealt with, including where is it appropriate to do this, the home rule issue that's in the courts now, liability issues. We've been reading this week about some insurance companies and what they're going to cover, and so on. These are very important issues. Unfortunately, the public debate has become so divisive that it's really obscuring the need and our ability to roll up our sleeves and try to address these public policy issues, because everybody is being persuaded to either be for this or against this. And when you overlay the energy considerations, the climate change considerations, the economic development considerations, landowner considerations, you really can't just say it's as simple as being for it or against it. So typically what I argue in favor of is more education as opposed to more advocacy. And ultimately, I think we need to be realistic about the environmental risks and how we address those while simultaneously crafting a smart energy policy. The last introductory point I want to make is reference something that recently came out of the International Energy Agency, which talks about how you need a regulatory protocol that's going to address the environmental issues, but it also talks about the need for a social license and the need for the community to accept this activity as being something that's not going to be catastrophic, and that is going to address the pressing energy and climate issues as well as be environmentally safe. And right now, it's not happening because of the nature of the public debate, and hopefully you leave here wanting to engage in a different kind of discussion than just I'm for it or I'm against it.
And finally, Andrew.
So my role here always has been, I'm not an expert, I do not have a PhD, but I've spent 30 years trying to get to understand science and to convey it to people in a way that's meaningful and that gets beyond headlines, whether it's global warming, just the last 2 days I've been writing about some very overheated coverage about Greenland's ice sheet, which I was lucky enough to stand on in 2004, 2 miles of vertical ice. I was up there for days with scientists trying to figure out what's going to happen to that ice sheet in a warming world. And you look online, you look on the TV news, and you probably saw in the last 24 hours reports Greenland's melting. And when in fact you get beyond the surface of that, what was seen was one day in which the surface of this 2.5 mile thick sheet of ice was above freezing. And so you have this little layer of ice form. And it's not a threat to sea level. And again, I'm deeply concerned about global warming. You know, I'm going to relate this to fracking in about 30 more seconds. But I hate when I see folks torque information to try to get attention, thinking that if you oversimplify, you then can galvanize people to act. But in fact, what you do is just hand your opposition ammunition when you say Greenland's melting, when the science is far more nuanced. So as a journalist, I've actually had to fight that habit we have as journalists to overstate what we know, whether it was back during the Gulf War when we were accepting a case for chemical weapons at the New York Times going into Iraq, or whatever. And so I try as often as I can to step back and analyze the evidence, actually say, what do we know? What don't we know? What can we learn? In other words, where are the gaps that are fillable in our information about whether it's fracking or global warming? And what's unknowable? And again, with like cancer rates in Texas, which I've just been spending days reporting out, essentially the idea that you can find anything meaningful in the data that's in Texas is a fantasy. But there's enough ambiguity that someone with an agenda can look at this and say, there's cancer and there's fracking, therefore there's a catastrophe. My agenda, my passion as a reporter is to convey the reality of an issue, even when it's inconveniently complex and inconveniently nuanced, as you heard here. But it takes a discipline as a reporter. It takes discipline as a consumer of news, I think, as well, to try to step back from the sort of bonanza kind of language that we're so saddled with, as Stu mentioned, and say, what do we actually know here? Spend just a few minutes getting beyond the headlines. And what I do on my blog every day, every night often as well, is try to look at these issues as a running conversation as opposed to a one-time story. And when you do that, you get much more of a sense of reality. And with fracking, you'll see here, I'm sure, and as many of you understand, there isn't going to be some magical solution here that's going to make everybody happy. The yelling will continue, the litigation will continue. And the one thing that I also think is a great source of power right now is that communities have never had more of a capacity than now because of the internet, because of global information systems for mapping things, because of technologies like infrared cameras, to take this matter into their own hands. If you live in an area and you think the well down the road is emitting methane, I don't know if you could pull up that clip. I just wanted to show you one little snippet of video that can illustrate this, or I can do it. So.
Yeah, well, let's.
Well, we can do it later. Anyway,
give me a little bit of breathing room to cue that up.
Well, we'll work it into the later part. Anyone with an infrared camera can go out there right now and take pictures that show you, or video that shows you there's a leak there. So again, the DIY aspect of this is there. DIY meaning do it yourself. So this idea that we should just wait for the DEC to have the capacity to be the police, we don't need that. So that's very exciting to me. We live in a great time for communities to empower themselves and get involved and map problems and also map the successes and move forward. So that's my spiel.
Well, thank you very much.